there's still so much to see.
You make me come alive.
Welcome to Explore Lake Murray Country, your guide to come alive in the jewel of South Carolina. I'm your host, Kelly Hughes. In the last episode, we heard a lot about the exciting adventures and experiences one can have in the four counties and on the lake. And today, we'll be exploring an extremely popular attraction in the region, Congaree National Park. Here today to teach us more about this beautiful piece of nature is John Manchester, Chief of Visitor Services at Congaree National Park. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
I'm really happy to speak with you and to meet you today. So just immediately going right in, I want to know about your history as a park ranger and what inspired you to work as a park ranger slash in nature.
Well, I started working for the Park Service back in 2009. My background is history. That's what I have a degree in. And so I always thought that I'd be working in some kind of a historical background place. And when I started with the Park Service, that's exactly what I was doing. Worked at a small historic site up in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And from there went to the National Mall in Washington, D.C., which that's talking about the breadth of American history. But then the next park I went to was a good mix of both nature and cultural history. So that was my first foray into being an interpretive park ranger, talking about not just what my bread and butter comfort area was, and realized that this is kind of fun too. I like talking about the natural side of a place because people are tied to our natural environment. And after doing three summer seasons on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, I was able to get a more permanent position at Congaree National Park. I was working on a master's degree. So I came here as a student, and that allowed me to eventually get a permanent position at Congaree. And it's not typical that a park ranger gets to stay at a park for a long period of time. Typically, we're there for a few years and then we want to go do something else. But Congaree just has really grabbed me because it's, as far as national parks go, fairly new. We're coming up on our 50th birthday here, and it's one of those kind of hidden gems. So I've gotten to do a lot of expanding on the stories we tell. It was always very much a natural history park, talking about the natural environment, and then I was able to bring my background of cultural history, human history, and kind of begin tying those together, which has been a lot of fun. So it'll be 10 years coming up next Monday, I believe, that I will have been at Congaree, and I've been able to, you know, do it from just a lowly student to a, you know, now today as the Chief of Visitor Services. And it's been just a wonderful ride, and I've loved every second of it. And, you know, most park rangers and park employees you meet, we love what we do. It's a fun job. We get to meet a lot of amazing people and get to be a part of protecting a lot of amazing places, a lot of amazing stories.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on upcoming 10 years. That's a huge milestone for you personally. I'm sure the park is really grateful to have you as well. But I'm curious, you said that park rangers don't typically stay with a national park for a long time. Why is that? Is it just like a circulation of people, or I want to know more about that.
I mean, people who want to move up in a job, which is most of us, we don't want to stay at a static level our entire careers. Typically, if you want to get that next step up, It's not often that you can get that at the same park you're working at. A lot of park rangers that anyone meets, if they are visiting national parks, they're seasonal rangers. They work 6 months and then either go to another park for 6 months, or they're not working for 6 months in a park. They might just be doing an off-season job. But once you get permanent, unless you're at a really big park, a place like Grand Canyon or Yellowstone, where jobs open up on a more frequent basis, it's kind of hard to move up in one park. In Congaree, we are a small park. We don't have a huge staff like Yellowstone or Grand Canyon or Yosemite.
Yeah.
So it's just been really just a good turn of events that those opportunities opened up, and that I've just been there when those opportunities opened, that I was able to step into those roles. And some people just, they like to go different places. Some people have that wanderlust that, you know, okay, I've been here at this park, but you know what? It'd be really fun to work out and, you know, work out the Grand Canyon. I'm going to go out there. Or, you know, they want those new experiences. They don't like being planted in one place. But I've just enjoyed Congaree so much. And I feel like there's still so much there that can be done that I want to keep doing those things. There's so many things to continue growing our program in, whereas some of the older parks, that's already been done.
Yeah. Congaree is very special to our region and the four counties. And a lot of our visitors, they make a very special trip out there. And there's lots to do. But before we dive into that part, I'd love to know more about the background and history of Congaree National Park. I personally, I've only been in the region for about, this will be my fifth year. I was a student at USC, originally from New Jersey. I said that last episode. But I've never been to Congaree, and that's on me. So I'd love to get, if I were a visitor, you can almost paint it as that. So tell me more about the history of the park.
Yeah. We got to get you down to the park. You got to come down. Yeah. It is an amazing place, and this is a great time of year to be down there as the temperatures get really nice, as fall sets in. But Congaree has been a unit of the National Park Service since 1976. And it's kind of one of those special places because it was people here in our area that pushed for it to become a national park unit. It was originally owned by a company that their main goal was lumber extraction. And prior to that, going back through the history of that landscape, you're looking at people who owned it for purposes of agriculture. It does have a tie to the plantation era, the antebellum era before the American Civil War, which also means it has a tie to the stories of African Americans here in the United States, the unfortunate conditions they had to experience being enslaved. So they have a tie to that landscape as well. And then even going back further, you're looking at thousands of years of Native American interaction with that landscape. You know, within this area of South Carolina, you know, we have at least 12,000 years of documented Native American history. And within the area of the park, that probably goes back at least 10,000, because we do have sites just outside the park that can go back. So Native Americans have been a part of that landscape for far longer than European Americans have been there. So, you know, we go back to 1540, and that's when the first Europeans show up, and eventually the 1700s when settlement begins to push in. And the landscape begins to slowly change from just a floodplain that, even though people call it a swamp, it's typically dry. We're not wet the majority of the year. And it's typically winter that we have those inundations that cover the landscape in water. This time of year, you're out there walking in a forest that, in some cases, is really, really old, which is one of the fascinating things about that park. And you're going out into some of those wilderness areas, and you're seeing trees that could be 500, 700, in some cases, maybe close to 1,000 or more years old.
Incredible.
So these trees are ancient, and they've seen so much human history. They can't tell that story because, you know, they don't speak to us, but, you know, that's one of the great things about being a park ranger. We get to be the voice. We speak for the trees, as Dr. Seuss said in The Lorax. But in the 1950s, the park had been owned by the Beidler family for over 50 years. And a man named Harry Hampton became very involved in the early efforts to try and save the landscape. It had been logged in the late 19th, early 20th century. Not extensively, thankfully. It wasn't clear cut. The bottomland landscape, similar to what we have at the park, used to cover, before settlement, 30 million acres, conservatively, of the southeastern United States. And we're the last remaining largely intact tract of old growth bottomland left. And we're only, the park is 26,600 acres, most of that being that bottomland. And only about 11,000 of that is old growth. So Harry Hampton fought to preserve that from being cut. And even though his efforts didn't really take off to the extent he wanted, it did inspire some other people just a little later on in the 1960s and 70s to take up that campaign. And it was their efforts through the 1970s up to 1976 that led to the park being created. And after it was established, it went from being a national monument to being a designated wilderness. So that's the highest level of protection that can be given to land. Mm. That means that we're not doing anything to really change how the natural systems work. We're trying to preserve the soundscape too. So if we have to do any work out there, a lot of it is getting done with traditional tools. We've got to clear a big tree off of a trail. We might be using two-person crosscut saws, which sounds crazy, but when you're out there in those, you know, wilderness areas looking for that solitude, you don't want to hear a still rev up. It kind of just messes with the ambiance. And that was in 1988, and then 15 years later, that's when the park got a redesignation as Congaree National Park. So that was 20 years ago in November that we have had our current designation. So we're one of 64 national parks, 425 national park units in the United States, and every one of them special. I can't say we're better than any one other park unit, but we do have things that a lot of other parks don't have.
Yeah.
So that is a nutshell version of the park history. I mean, there's a lot that when you really delve into the park history, it's very, very, very intriguing and interesting about all the nuances and everything that people don't necessarily see it because it's a natural environment. The human touches for a large part have been completely overtaken by nature again. It's being reclaimed.
Yeah.
But it's still there if you know what to look for.
Yeah, absolutely. That is so fascinating. And even though that was a nutshell, I can't wait to tell my friends and family about everything I just learned from that, you know, brief example and information that you provided. But I can tell that you care so much about this national park and you know so much, and you're definitely built for the role as Chief of Visitor Services. But I want to know more about what that role entails. What else do you do besides discuss the history?
So the Chief of Visitor Services role, I oversee a couple different aspects of our operations at the park. First and foremost is the interpretation of the park. People won't care about a national park if they don't understand what a national park or any unit of a national park service is about if they don't hear about it, if it's not made accessible to them. Mm-hmm. So and as interpreters, the people that work for my division, you know, we're trying to make the park accessible to people through programming and social media, creating new exhibits and waysides that go out in the park so people can gain a better grasp of what makes this place important. Why should I care about it? So it's building connections for the public. That could be through a program that goes 20 minutes, maybe longer if it's a guided walk. It might just be a short interaction with visitors at the visitor center. But each one of those, no matter the length, can be very, very impactful. And on top of that, I help to manage the fee program. So that's something that's been building at the park. While we don't have an entrance fee at the park, we do charge fees for camping and a few other things. So that helps us to maintain the campgrounds and fund some of our maintenance that needs to get done. On top of that, I also have taken on the role of managing some of our permits. So people wanting to come in to maybe run canoe tours and things like that, that would need what's called a commercial use authorization. So I operate that. People wanting to come in and do things that we call special park uses, which that varies broadly. I manage those permits and everything as well, making sure that they get issued and that whatever's being done is being done correctly. And other than those roles, a lot of us take on a lot of other collateral duties. So I help with our search and rescue program. I help with our wild and fire program. Those are a couple of things that have become very important for the park. We use fire to try and push the restoration of our upland area of the park. That's a part of the park that gets ignored a lot because it's not the old growth. Mm. Everyone kind of says, I've seen pine trees. They're a dime a dozen. But we're trying to bring back the longleaf pine ecosystem that would have been more prevalent prior to people settling that area and changing it to more suit their needs through agriculture and everything. And search and rescue is a very important part. Thankfully, it's not as much of what we have to do as it's been in the past, because we've really begun working hard to make sure that all the visitors know what to expect. We call that preventative search and rescue. So making sure everybody knows, oh, you're going out on a 10-mile trail. Do you have these things with you? Because if you don't have those things, it might not work out the way you want it to work out. And through that messaging, we've made sure that a lot of people don't get lost and have an unpleasant experience. You know, my first year at the park, we had, in the first 6 months, I think we had 14 search and rescues where people just got turned around. They weren't prepared for what they were doing. And thankfully, over this last year, I think we've had two.
That's
so
great.
And those have been very, very minor, easy ones to take care of. And some of those in the first 6 months of my time there were 3 days.
Wow.
They were long. So that's been something that has been an important part of, you know, what I get to do in my role.
Yeah, you got a lot on your plate, and I'm sure, you know, you rely on one another in your team and everyone else who works at the park. So I want to go ahead and just thank you for your time and dedication to the Park Service, especially hearing about that search and rescue information. And I think a lot of people overlook what our national park has to offer, especially locals. Maybe they visited it once or twice. And I feel like we just need to get more of a conversation about all the offerings of the national park. I know a lot of people know about the firefly synchronization, which I'd love for you to talk about a little bit. And I just found out about the fall migration of the monarch butterflies, two beautiful natural wonders that happen right here in our four-county region in South Carolina. So how can people learn more about the firefly synchronization? How can they have the opportunity to go see that at the national park?
So we offer that program every spring. It's something that kind of exploded on us. It was one of those things that locals knew about it prior to 2015, 16. And once the word got out, because fireflies are not something that everyone really gets to experience as much anymore, and synchronized fireflies especially is something far more unique. It really kind of went from nothing to a huge event almost overnight, it seemed. And we were seeing 2,000 visitors a night, and it was beginning to have an impact on that landscape. So in order to make sure that we would have those fireflies for future visitors to come in and see, what we did was we created a lottery-style system, similar to what the Great Smokies has been using for a while for their synchronized fireflies. And we do have a different species. So if you were to come to our park and then go to Great Smokies, you would get a different event. You're going to be seeing something very different because their fireflies are a completely different species. It has meant that it does limit how many people can come, which we do understand that that does make some people sad when they want to come out and see the fireflies. But we also try to make sure that it's as fair as possible on that lottery. So we don't do anything that says, you know, one group gets a jump over another. We keep the lottery open for typically a week, 7 days. Everyone has that chance to put in. You're not going to go in after 25 minutes and everything's already been booked up. Thankfully, it's not like a concert where if you're not on there real quick, you miss out. But that has helped us not only to make sure we have the staff and the equipment for that, because that lottery, the money that comes in for that allows us to help fund that event, because it does take a lot of staff hours to do that. We're working a lot of night shifts, for some cases doing a lot of overtime, try to keep that down, because it's exhausting after 2 weeks of doing the event. But it's always worth it to see the people coming in and the magic of those fireflies, seeing a family with young children who maybe they're not really used to seeing fireflies, and they see for the first time the magic, not just of fireflies, but fireflies all going at the same time. It's just, that makes all the tiredness that we feel totally worth it. And we've been regularly trying to build the program over the past few years to make it as accessible, bring in as many people as we can without overwhelming the area where the fireflies are, because too many people, unfortunately, too much love is sometimes just as bad as not enough love. And then we have the fall where we get the migration of not just birds, but butterflies too. We'll see a lot of butterflies that are coming through our park, monarchs being one of them. We do have native aquatic milkweed that they will use for their journey south. And they're one of a number of different, you know, beautiful butterfly species that we get to see in the fall. A lot of bright colors, not just in the trees, but, you know, a lot of oranges and yellows and different shades of color that the butterflies provide flitting around through the floodplain. So that's one of the great things about making sure that we're not overly inhibiting the natural ecosystem there, because it allows our wildlife to thrive.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm honestly moved by what you said about the firefly synchronization and how you guys handle that. I think that's so, like, conscious of the environment and so forward thinking. I feel like in our world these days, not a lot of people are kind of approaching events and public opportunities like that.
And we noticed a huge change just in a few years. In 2020, because of the rise of COVID and it being early in that pandemic, we couldn't have those huge groups coming together. It did give us a chance as park staff to, let's go do some data collection. Let's go observe the fireflies and see what we've got going on, because many of us had remembered it from the years before there was an event. And when you're working at an event, you don't get to pay as much attention to it. But getting out there and watching it, you're looking at it and saying, it doesn't look like there's as many fireflies as there were. And that data collection kind of gave us the information that we needed to say, look, we need to make sure that impacts to the landscape that could mean no fireflies 5 years from now don't continue. And so we're getting to see that event hopefully come back to what we had seen prior to the event really kicking off. So we'll see what we get. They're on a 2-year cycle. It was a good event this year.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's just going to keep getting better and better as each year goes forward.
Yeah, I hope so. And also, I think it's really special, especially from a visitor standpoint with the lottery system. I think that if you get chosen for the lottery and you get your opportunity to go see these fireflies, it's almost just that much more special. Like, you were chosen to have that opportunity to go see this beautiful natural phenomenon that happens in our state.
Indeed.
And the firefly synchronization is just one of many awesome opportunities that Congaree National Park offers. But I want to know more about like recreational things that you can do while you're spending time at the park.
So because we are predominantly wilderness, we don't have roads that go through the park. So not like Yosemite, Great Smokies, Yellowstone, that you can drive through the majority of the park. Ours is foot travel. So we have opportunities for people to, you know, go out and walk or hike through the park. Opportunities that are available for people of pretty much every ability. Most popular would be our boardwalk. We have a 2.5-mile boardwalk loop trail that starts and comes back to the visitor center. It's accessible for families with young kids, people who might have a disability and they can't easily get around on a trail that has lots of roots or could be extremely muddy. Maybe they have a wheelchair or scooter, or just they can't really walk in an area that has so many tripping hazards. It's got a lot of very level walkways, benches for people to sit down. So it's a good spot for pretty much anybody coming out to the park. And it's really going to give visitors kind of the big picture in a small frame. We've got a self-guided boardwalk tour that you can take around the boardwalk. You'll learn about just the history, both natural and cultural, of the landscape. And if you only got an hour, you can really understand at least the basics of the park just doing that 2.5-mile walk. And then for people who are a little more adventurous, we have, you know, longer standard ground trails that go from a couple miles to 10 to 12 miles round trip. And those are ones people need to be prepared for. Definitely be ready for a wilderness experience, making sure that you're, you know, looking for each trail marker as you go, because you can get turned around out there because those trails aren't as heavily traveled, but it gives people the opportunity to find some solitude. And you're 25 minutes away from a fairly large metropolitan area. but it feels like you're out in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. You really do feel like you're very secluded, that you're not close to civilization. And that's one of the great things about what our park offers, as it offers those opportunities to get out into a natural landscape where you're not going to be so inundated with the noise that you're going to get in a city park. And people who don't want to go hiking, they can also, if they have a kayak or go to one of the local outfitters to get a kayak or canoe, can go out on the creek. We have a 6.5 mile marked canoe trail that goes between our two landings, and then past the second landing, you can keep on going down to the Congaree River. So people can do multi-day paddling trips through the park. It can be challenging depending on the time of year, due to things like water levels. When the water levels get real low, you've got all kinds of stuff on the bottom that'll catch you up and everything like that, or sandbars, things like that, that'll hang you up for a minute or two. And then we get lots of trees that come down. So maybe some portaging and everything, but it's all part of the experience. It's a challenge. It really makes you, you know, have to work to do some of the things you want to do, but, you know, it's a sense of accomplishment at the end of it. And I think that's an important part of wilderness areas, is taking the challenge and making it through. People can go backpacking and do backcountry camping. We've got two campgrounds in the front country that people can make reservations for those on recreation.gov. And if they'd like to do backcountry camping, it's right now a free backcountry camping permit. They can go on our website and send us an email to request one. So there's lots of opportunities to get out into the park that you might not get at other parks, because you have the opportunities to drive or do a lot of those things. And here, you gotta get out and be on your feet, or be in a canoe and going kind of at a slower pace. It helps you see things too. You get to understand more of the landscape because you're going at nature's pace.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you brought up accessibility, and I love to know more about Congaree's resources for accessibility, especially, you know, are there different types of vehicles / wheelchairs that people can take so that they can be more involved in their experience at the park?
Yeah, so we do make sure that if someone comes out and they want to go out on the boardwalk, but they need a wheelchair or something like that, we do have those available for people to borrow while they're out there. We get a lot of families that might come out with, you know, grandparents or someone who recently broke a leg, something like that. And so, you know, doing a 2.5 mile loop might not be easy for them. So we have that opportunity for them to get out there available by offering those wheelchairs. We do have some wheelchairs that are specifically designed for being more rugged. They can be navigated by one person, but they are more suited to having a second person either pushing or pulling. But unlike just a standard wheelchair, which wouldn't do so well on our trails off the boardwalk, these can do those, even though it is still, it's a little bit of a challenge. And even though we have a lot of trails that aren't boardwalk, they aren't paved, those trails are open and accessible for anybody of any ability to go out on them. If they have any kind of wheelchair, it's motorized and it's meant to be a wheelchair and can go do those things, they can get out there and do that. We try to make sure that anybody with visual impairments can get our information. We have our brochure in Braille so that anybody who's sight impaired can come in and get a copy of that and use that while they're visiting. We do make sure that everything we put out media-wise, if it's visual media, is audio described and everything. So we do make a concerted effort to make everything accessible for anybody of any ability.
Yeah, that's really incredible. And I think we need to spread the word a little bit more on that, because I'm sure that some people may avoid somewhere where, you know, the main thing to do is to hike or to walk trails. It's important that you guys have those resources and that people know about them and that everyone can be included and really appreciate this beautiful national park. But I want to switch gears really quickly. I want to know about the Congaree Biosphere Reserve.
So the Congaree Biosphere Reserve is, it's a group that we help to support. We don't run it. We're not overseeing it or administering it. That is a program through the United Nations, the UNESCO. So we're a part of a larger group of different stakeholders throughout our region. Because even though the park kind of forms the core of the Biosphere Reserve, it extends well outside the Biosphere Reserve. So trying to make sure that there is an understanding that we have unique environments around our country, that's what the Biosphere Reserve and the world, that's what the Biosphere Reserve program is trying to do, is to push for the stewardship of those landscapes. There's no regulatory oversight from the UN for the Biosphere Reserve, but it's a very good program that has brought together a lot of stakeholders from our local community to, you know, discuss, you know, how we can make sure that not just the park landscape is protected, but other areas that are connected to the park are maintained as natural as can be, and avoid some of the pitfalls that can happen with, you know, more developed areas being close by.
Yeah, the history of the park and the beautiful nature and environment that make it up, I think that's really important. Preservation is really important. And I love that conversation. I love that the national parks have really taken initiative. And it's always something we're talking about. I see it on social media. I see it in the news. And it's just really important. I can't say really, I can't really expand anymore on that. And Congaree is going to have its 50th birthday coming up, and also the 250th birthday of the United States of America, which blew my mind, crazy. So those are some big milestones coming up, especially for a U.S. national park. I'd love to know about any plans that the park may have for that those events.
So we're in the beginning stages. So nothing at this point has been has been set in stone. We're still 3 years out from both of those. It's kind of fortuitous that both happen the same year. You know, we were formed the year of the bicentennial. We're celebrating our 50th when the nation is celebrating its 250th. So we do want to make sure that what we provide to the public, you know, makes the story of Congaree as a national park unit really accessible. This will probably also be one of the last birthday celebrations we get where we can bring in a lot of the people who were part of that movement to create the park. Because while they were all, you know, in their 20s and 30s back in the 1970s, you know, they're now in their 70s, 80s. So they're you know, getting up in years. And so by the time we get to our 75th birthday, it's very likely we won't have any of those people to connect the park today to those people who were so passionate about preserving it so that it could be a national park today. So as we go into those planning stages of what we're going to do to celebrate that birthday in 2026, we'll be putting a lot of stuff up on our website, on social media to share all the amazing programs that hopefully we'll be able to provide during that year. And then for the 250th of the United States, there is a connection to the park landscape, to the Revolutionary War era, with the Bates Ferry Trail being formerly a ferry road that was a strategic place that both British and American Patriot forces were trying to either capture and deny to the other side, or hold and protect to maintain their lines of communication and supply. So we, in the past year, have actually installed 6 wayside exhibits, wayside panels out there along that trail to help explain a little bit more of that story. Which led up to one of the only actual armed actions within our area of more substantial length, not just some kind of a skirmish that happened in May of 1781, which is the siege and battle of Fort Mott. And so hopefully we'll be able to do some really cool programming around that, maybe some living history, and possibly even getting people to other sites not as easily accessed through some special tours to talk about that story and how our park landscape connects to the story of our nation's founding.
That is really cool. And I think it is so interesting how integrated history and nature is at Congaree National Park. And it's not right down the road, but it's right here in our region. And I'm sure a lot of people make it an important trip during the summertime or the fall to go do stuff with their families or to bring their families from out of town to come check it out because it really is special. And for anyone who is not from the area, what are some important things that people would need to know before visiting the park? I know that you mentioned, you know, be prepared if you're planning on walking a trail, you know what you're getting into before you step out there because there's a lot of turnarounds or you might not be able to do what you planned. But is there anything important, especially in your opinion, that people should know about before they visit?
So I always tell people, check our website before coming out. We always try to make sure that any important information, especially when it comes to access to the park, is posted as an alert on our website. So we're a floodplain, we flood, and when the park does go into flood stage, it does mean a lot of our trails are inaccessible. So making sure that you check to see, it's like, are we in flood stage? We'll post that every time and let people know that, hey, park's underwater right now, so the low boardwalk and all of our trails out in the floodplain for the most part are going to be hard to access or not accessible at all. However, we've got the elevated boardwalk, which almost never goes under except in the most extreme floods, and all the upland trails will still be accessible as well. And also checking out trail information, how long trails are, what to expect on those trails, all that information is on our website as well. So things can be deceiving at times. We get a lot of people who want to do the river trail and they think, oh, easy access to get down to the river. It must be much like the river walk here in Columbia. It's a very different experience than the river walk here in Columbia. It is a 4-mile walk one way, most of it in wilderness on trails that do not see as many people, so they're not as easy to follow. Mm-hmm. They do get trail damage from storms, trees that come down. So if you decide to go out on one of those longer trails, making sure that you have what are known as the 10 hiking essentials, making sure you've got plenty of water, making sure you're wearing the right shoes and clothes, and you have the right stuff for the forecast that is predicted for that day. So even if it's a nice bright sunny day, have a rain jacket because hypothermia can happen in the summertime, just like it can happen in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Being aware of everything that you should expect on whatever you're planning to do is important. And if you've got questions that the website doesn't necessarily answer for you, or maybe you aren't as clear to you as you need, give us a call. We're always happy to answer those questions for us. And we always recommend stopping at the visitor center when you get there. There are staff and volunteers there from 9 to 5 daily, except on certain federal holidays. And we're happy to answer questions for you. Get a map, get a brochure, have the stuff you need to navigate the trails if you're going out on those trails. And ask those questions. And if somebody gives you a piece of advice saying, maybe don't go on that trail, that's always something to listen to. We don't say anything lightly. We don't want to keep people from going out into the park, but we want people also to be very aware of what they're going to be getting themselves into if they take on certain experiences.
Now, is the park open year-round?
So the park itself, the park grounds are open 24/7, except if we're in a special closure like we do for the fireflies. Mm-hmm. So we do close the front country access during that time just to, you know, limit the number of people who would be potentially going to impact that firefly habitat when they're coming in. But for the most part, if we're not in a hurricane or something like that, people can come in even after 5 o'clock. We don't close the gates most nights, and they can come in and go hiking on the boardwalk, on other trails. They're not lit, so make sure you've got a flashlight. One of the most common mistakes we find is people starting their trip really late in the day and thinking, oh, if it gets too dark, I've got my cell phone. Mm. Cell phones do have flashlights, but those aren't reliable flashlights. That eats your battery quick. And if you do need help, you don't have a cell phone battery, you're not going to be able to call for help. So that's one of the things we always say as part of the 10 essentials. Bring a flashlight, especially if you're coming out later in the day. And the visitor center will always have maps and everything outside the visitor center, even if the visitor center itself is closed. There will be maps available for people to grab if they need one.
Well, that's awesome. And so we're going to wrap up. Thank you, John, for coming on to our podcast and for keeping us informed on all things Congaree National Park. For more information on the park, follow at Congaree NPS on Instagram and Congaree National Park on Facebook, or visit nps.gov/Kong, C-O-N-G. And that wraps up this episode of Explore Lake Murray Country. Thank you for listening, and you can keep up with us at Lake Murray Country on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and follow us on X or Twitter at Lake Murray CTRY. And do not forget to visit lakemurraycountry.com to start planning your trip.
Hey!
You make me come alive.
I've never felt so free.
Can't get you off my mind. There's still so much to see.
You bring out the best in me.
There's still so much to see.
You make me come alive. I never felt so